Good evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop serving up John Shepherd on the Blue Plate Special. John is a writer with Down and Out Books, and he has been nominated for the Anthony for the third installment of his Shill series, which starts out The Shill, Kill the Shill, and Beware the Shill. He's also a Seamus Award-winning author and a writer-director of TV movies. His Shill novellas were inspired by noir master James Cain, and you're going to find it terse, tense, and twisty. I can definitely vouch for that twisty part because it's all about the art of deception. So, good evening, John, and welcome to the Blue Plate Special.
Hey, Terry, thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the Anthony nomination for Beware the Shill. What category are you nominated in?
Well, I'm in the novella category, which is great because, I don't think there's been a novella category for the Anthony, although I'm not quite sure. So it's part of the, every year, the awards committee gets to choose what they call a wild card. So it could be an audiobook or it could be something different. And they chose novellas, which I applaud because I think novellas are, they just don't get, really get enough kind of, no one really shines enough light on them. And I'm certainly glad they did.
Make something a novella.
Well, technically what makes a novella is the length. Like about a 30,000 word short novel, and that's technically what it is. But I see it as a very tight novel.
Mm-hmm.
It boils down to the economy of the story. You don't have a lot of room for other stuff now. When I want a novel and I want that other stuff and I really want to know all about the location. I want to seep through little side stories. I love that too, but I've always loved the short format. I mean, it started with Of Mice and Men and it went on to Voltaire, both novellas I had to read in school. And then as I got older, James M. Cain, he'd mentioned earlier, brilliant, Postman Always Rings Twice, and of course, Double Indemnity. I just love that format at that length. You can do so much with so little.
And I fully agree with you because I can tell you that I can see the Shill books with lurid covers on the spinner rack at the dime store. They have a
very much
pulpy feel to them.
That's the idea. I'm very much inspired by I'm inspired. I grew up in Colorado and I remember there were truck stops and I'd go into truck stops and there's these dime store paperbacks for, and you'd see them or at the Woolworth or TG and Y, these places in the Midwest and the West and that era of that tight crime novella it had a very strong impression on me as a young reader, and here I am.
Well, and I'm sitting here at my desk. My day job is I deal in antiques and collectibles. Pretty much the odder, the better. And I'm sitting here with a stack of Edwin S. Aaron's paperbacks on my desk right now. They're the Sam Durrell mystery series. And I agree with you completely because they're exactly that. They were originally, 50-cent faucet gold medal books. And I can, again, your Shill series fits right next to those. So,
thank you for saying that, for Terry, because that's exactly what I intended. So, when I set out to write these,
I picked a little blurb for the third book, which I'll run through. It's Life Can Turn on a Dime Against the Jagged Cliffs of California's Central Coast. Bruised, battered, but determined, James Innes must navigate a tangled web of deception, depravity, and murder, and turn the tables on cunning swindlers. Using the art of deception, this out-of-work actress embarks on a daring caper, her last chance to take down a deadly adversary. Ooh. Tell us a little bit about what the Shill series is all about.
Well, it all starts with a character, Jane Innes, who is a struggling actress in Los Angeles. I work in film and television, have done for years, and made television films that you talked about and done, you know, worked every probably job on every crew ever. I mean, I've been in Los Angeles here for a long time and a number of years. And I've always, the Jane character is basically a meld of people I've known, actresses I've known, kind of blonde ambition. And she's getting a little older. She's not getting the role. She takes all these crummy jobs. And then in her acting class, she comes across this handsome older gentleman who seduces her and then takes her wines and dines her. And of course, then dumps her. And she's like, what's going on? She can't get a hold of him. Finally, she does. And she asks, well, what's the matter? And he admits to her, look, I'm a con man, and I'm looking for a partner to help me do a scheme. And I can't approach the mark myself. I need to go through his wife. So I need someone to pose as my wife. And we socialize as couples. And you're not right. And she's like, what do you mean I'm not right? I'm like, I can tell. You don't have an ounce of larceny in your soul. You're too sweet. You're too caring. And she's like, wait a minute. I'm an actress. That's a role. I can play that role. So, of course, she's into it. He agrees. And I was, when I started writing it, what fascinated me was, you know, My Fair Lady or Pygmalion, taking a girl from the other side of the tracks and making her something that she's not. And in this case, Jane is this, you know, very much comes from a, you know, single parent family, very much blue collar, and really is, you're destined to be a waitress all her life. But here, she's got to play a carefree heiress. She has to play this woman who has no care, and it just is, and she's got to be schooled how to, you know, everything she's got to, you know, everything that she never learned. In a way, Cooper, who's the con man, he gives her kind of a finishing school to make her right, and then that's the first caper which gets her into the first book called The Shill. So that's how we start, that's my main character.
Do you know what this actually reminds me of, what it calls back to, is the 1970 James Coburn movie, You've Got a Harry in Your Pocket.
Oh, listen, I'm a big fan of that. I remember that. I remember that very well. That's a great mentor story, actually. I know that. And I'm also, I'm also a big kind of, I've been collecting con and deception stuff. Probably starts because as a kid I was a magician. And so I'm very familiar with any movie or any kind of like sleight of hand trick that involves money. I mean, it's like I've been part of that forever. So, of course, you know, Harry in Your Pockets is all about a pickpocket, and that's a great movie. That's the pickpocket movie. That and of course, Pickup on South Street. So, yeah.
Yes, but that same thing of that mentoring and bringing somebody into the con and into the scam, that was the movie I immediately thought of. So you come by it honestly.
I love capers. I love a great caper. I love characters that would never be in this but are kind of drawn into it. And that's what started me with Jane. And it was the idea. So that's the first book, and then things escalate and twist and turn, and as you'd mentioned, and then by the time we get to the third book, which is the Anthony-nominated book, the way I describe it is she's she begins as a pawn and becomes a rook,
mm-hmm.
meaning that, first of all, she's just supposed to be a sacrifice. You know, you sacrifice this person
yes.
For an ultimate goal. But they didn't realize. These con men that brought her in and this whole syndicate, that this whole idea, they had no idea how capable she was. And actually what a great actress she is, which is she uses
yes.
to deceive them. And then that's her arc. She goes from a pawn to a rook, and the rook can take down a queen on that chessboard. So that's the theme.
Yes, Veronica, so evil. she is just totally evil. And I love your ancillary characters too. I really like the character of Danny. I have to admit, I'm totally channeling and visualizing, you know, when Glenn Frey was on Miami Vice and played the pilot on Miami Vice. I'm totally
sure.
channeling that image when I think about Danny. You know, kind of
yeah.
if that character had lived to retire, although I don't think you ever retire.
Well, Danny, you know, the third book takes us, as you know, to Florida, and
mm-hmm.
and Danny becomes her stepfather, her
mm-hmm.
mother's boyfriend, who they end up getting married, and so he's family, and eventually, because of her troubles, he admits that I've had troubles in my past too. And we
mm-hmm.
get to learn, as you know, that that he was part of I was always been fascinated about that kind of that era, the Oliver North Iran Contra kind of
mm-hmm.
all that kind of
yes.
you know, all that kind of stuff that was, you know, that kind of Florida of that time, I guess, and he was just a courier back then,
yes.
and then became involved in some nasty stuff and barely escaped with his life. But then here it is, and hid himself and got away and changed himself. But all these years later, that comes back. So all
yep.
those years later, that comes back. And that, of course, engages Jane. And that's kind of how – it's also how they kind of share something together. They both have an ounce of larceny in their soul, both of them. So he was a very fun character to write, and I was very much encouraged by I love characters that have something to hide, and then
yes.
we as a reader get to learn that.
I was working in the Caribbean, geez, actually not too long after that particular era you're talking about. And we took a multi-island trip, you know, for the weekend. And basically, Danny was our pilot. Because
yeah.
he was everything you expected him to be. And I fully believe that he probably flew tourists on the weekend and cocaine during the week. That is, I just absolutely positively believe that. And he had this little rattletrap plane, and he told us not to lean on the doors, you know, as we all strapped ourselves in. Yeah, he told us not to lean on the door latches. So, yeah, those are the best characters ever. And all of them, even I was expecting Jane's mom to be a little bit more stick in the mud, and she wasn't. She's an engaging character in her own right. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. No thing. I just said, yeah, Jane's mother. I see her as a real kind of. She's the one source of love Jane has in her life. She's the
mm-hmm.
one, and she's not the most stable. You know, she's definitely all over the place, but she's what Jane calls home.
Yes.
and relies on that. But then as you know, she's not entirely honest with her because Jane's got a mission, and
everybody has a secret in this Shill series. You know, this is I'm trying to think of another movie. It'll come to me in a minute where you're. It never stops for a second. Everything is part of the caper. You know, very Ocean's 11, very you've got a Harry in your pocket, that type of thing. Everything's about the caper. I thoroughly enjoy that.
Thank you. I mean, I love it too. And there's a lot of authors out there that I just can't read enough of. Wallace Strobe being one of them, who writes the Chris Stone series. That's great. It's just great stuff. And then of course we go back to the masters of Lionel White and Donald Westlake and the caper guys who showed us how it's all done. I mean, it's incredible. I love that stuff. It's so much fun for a reader or an audience of a movie to be behind the scenes in something. And that's what inspires me to put it down. So.
Now, questions on these three books. Obviously, it's a trilogy, but I stepped in on the third one, Beware the Shill, and felt comfortable. I felt like I learned enough about the characters as I went along. And did you try and do that? Did you try and make them somewhat standalone?
I did. I realized that these are three novellas in a series, and anyone could just pick up one in the middle. So I had to make each one its own entity, its own. And then, you know, the tough thing, because we've all read series mysteries, is that the author has to explain the backstory of a character, and if you'd read the previous novels, you already know it. So you can't dust those apples too long. You can't all that exposition. So it's how you weave it through, and so that was a big, I'm very conscious of how is this. If I were just to pick up this book and just read it, would I still get all the backstory and learn everything else? So that was important to me in getting through it, is that they are three standalones.
Well, and it's part of the novella format, too. You also have to keep it very tight. Well, I can tell you, reading Beware the Shill over my luncheons over the last few days in my favorite coffee shops, that you do that. I knew enough to be able to carry it forward. And obviously, I don't know all of the details of the first caper or the second caper that ended up going so wrong, and when, you know, how she came to this very desperate place where she's at right now. But I feel comfortable with it going forward. So I wanted to tell you, you did a good job on that.
Well, thank you.
Because I get a lot of, as I do these interviews, I get a lot of authors' most recent books, and many of them are in a series. You know, they're the farther along book in the series. And one of the ways that I judge them is how comfortable I am with the character, and do I want to go back and pick up some of the earlier ones? So you're doing a good job on that. I'm now intrigued about both the Shill and Kill the Shill. And we'll be heading back to read those and pick the rest of the story up as we go along. So I just wanted to compliment you on that.
Well, thank you. You know how when I realized you'd mentioned capers, I realized, I said, well, I can do a caper in the first, but I can't really the second. But the third is a caper. So really, the second book, Kill the Shill, is really more of a detective story, and that's where Jane is really like. That's where she goes from the victim to you know, someone who is not gonna take it. So and is gonna do the right thing. So that's the arc. You know, that's the fun part of this stuff, isn't it? I mean, you're a writer, you know, to take a character
Definitely.
And make them grow and move them through this space and challenges, and I don't know, it's just, you know, if I wasn't such a geek about it, but I just love doing it, and that's my, you know, then I had a real good time writing this series.
Well, I understand that because, for example, in my first book, you know, she works at a silk stocking law firm in downtown Dallas. By the time we open the second book, she's behind the bar in a strip club in Biloxi, Mississippi. So mayhem ensues between those two points.
And you do the legal thriller stuff. So you do the stuff that has real kind of law and cases and everything else involved, don't you?
Yes and no, because you have to you you can't put too much of that in, because as I was talking with Meg Gardner, who is also a lawyer, it's really easy for that stuff to get boring. Really, really easy. Because when law is done correctly, you have beat every last little bit of drama out of it. So you just have to do the same thing. You have to sprinkle it in here and there to make it authentic, but to not just bore people to death with what goes on in court, because it's not nearly as exciting as most people think it is. And you know this too from working in TV. You know, you've only got this, what, anywhere from half an hour to what, maybe 90 minutes for a TV movie, you know, to run an entire three-act story arc. And it's got to be tight, you know, like a Law and Order, where a typical case that you'd see on Law and Order in real life, that'd take like 3 years, you know, and they get 45 minutes to do it. So what kind of movies have you worked on? Go ahead.
Well, I started my career. I wrote and directed a movie called Teenage Bonnie and Klepto Clyde. That was produced by, this was the time when Blockbuster videos were on every corner, and there was a real need for content, and it was produced by a very notorious producer, Menachem Golan, and he had made many, many movies. I mean, a lot of, you know, he's including the, you know, Chuck Norris movies, and he's a guy that made a lot of genre films. And of Golan and Globus, or Canon Pictures, was his peak. So I had made that, and I made that picture, and from there went to some other films, but you know, the crime picture has always been kind of my, I don't know, it's always been my love. And then over time, I really made TV movies because I mean, I've made two Christmas films, and the last two films I made were for Sci-Fi Channel.
Cool.
One of them titled Chupacabra Dark Seas, and about a chupacabra on a cruise ship, and then the last one, Jersey Shore Shark Attack. And even though those are genre action pictures, they're really technically comedies. They're you know, we play them straight for life or death, but they're a little tongue in cheek. But they're certainly fun to make, and a challenge on a very short schedule and budget. But you know, it's great. So it's fun, and so that's kind of what I, you know, that's kind of my career. And then I also work for a horse racing network as making their on-air promos. So I do that, and that's kind of what keeps me busy in between sneaking in some hours to write some crime fiction.
So somebody did, when they were passing this around on social media, somebody said that you knew a thing or two about horse racing.
Yeah, I do. Horse racing is... I've been working for a number of years we're basically Sports Center for horse racing, a network called TVG, and I do the on-air promos and commercials for them, it's another love of mine. And actually, speaking of horse racing, there's a couple mystery riders that your audience and you and I may know, probably. I think you've interviewed him before. Robert Randisi is an incredible handicapper. This guy, I work at a horse racing network, but I listen to Robert's tips because what I'll do is, Robert, if for the viewers or excuse me, the people listening that aren't familiar, Robert is an extremely, extremely prolific writer. It's astonishing how much he's written, and he's a founder of the Private Eye Writers of America, and just the greatest guy you've ever met. And it just astonishes me, and it's how good his stuff is, and how quickly he just cranks it out. I mean, it's really good. He writes in many genres, matter of fact, his very first book was a horse racing mystery called The Disappearance of Penny. That was his first book he wrote, back when he was a kid in Brooklyn. And it's a great book. I've read that. But Robert is, and this guy can pick a winner like nobody's business. When it comes around to like the Breeders' Cup or Kentucky Derby, and we're all looking at the past performances, I can listen to my on-air experts, sure, these guys have great opinions, but I certainly take Robert's opinion, very heavy. That's, because this guy over time has really picked a lot of great winners. So
that's fabulous. That's great. And what a skill. And obviously too, it's the love of the sport. And a deep and abiding understanding of the sport. So, was there someone else that does like horse race themed, or is into the sport that you're going to say as a writer as well?
Well, one thing I've noticed about all my writer friends is everyone loves horse racing. Like everybody's very much, very much loves that. Yeah, we all do. But Jason Starr, who's actually contributed to, there was an anthology for horse racing short stories published years ago. He contributed to, and he also wrote a great horse racing, very noir book, which Hard Case Crime put out called Fake ID. This guy, like, he and I have gone to the track together. I mean, this is a guy that we get together and we got to find a day at the track. So horse racing is something that, this guy's good too. It's interesting how they both approach, but Jason's very practical. He's got a real kind of practical look at it. From experience, mm-hmm. and plus he loves it, so it's great. I mean, those, it's so much fun to swap our picks and razz each other afterwards and do everything else that horse fans do. So anyway,
I'm gonna pretend you wear fedoras whether you do or not, because you should be if you're not doing it. So what are you, now that you've got the Shill trilogy wrapped up, what's next for you?
Well, will be my first novel titled Bottom Feeders coming out next year. And it's a whodunit. And it takes place, it's funny, speaking about mystery writers, there's a group that I get together with here in Los Angeles, probably not as often as I should because I've been so busy, one of the writers there was like, John, I would tell these stories because I've made like 9 of these low budget films for these colorful producers and over the years. And I would tell these stories and they're like, you got to write that down. I'm like, you're right. I have to write these. This is a world that I really know. And it's not the world it's not the world of the stars and the agents and the managers and the limo drivers. It's not that world. It's the world of the grind, the bottom feeders, the people that are on the bottom grinding away these low-budget, quickie movies, this bad television, bad reality TV. They're just working. And the idea is they want to rise up. They want to, their career, they start and rise up. And so it's a whodunit based on these characters. So
that is superb. I mean, that is just superb, because if I'm got this correct, you're telling me that my really good friend who works for Pixar, this isn't about his daily job.
No, it's not about the Pixar if you watch Lifetime and they have all these movies on all the time, you're like, where do these movies come from? And they're all these quickie, low budget thrillers, domestic thrillers made by people that are paid very little, but aspire for something more. And that's kind of where my book comes from. It's a, it's a low budget Western, and they're going to shoot it up here in Los Angeles at the they have a small Western ranch. They're going to make it, and then they go up there, and things kind of go bad from worse, and then they have to evacuate because a fire is approaching, which we have here in California. We have these crazy wildfires that decimate acres, but not everyone gets out, and those who are left behind, very much in a Agatha Christie kind of 10 little Indians, get picked off one by one.
I was about to ask you if it was basically 10 little Indians set in a low budget Western.
Yeah,
and
that's fabulous. Yeah, that's the story. So I'm really excited about it. It was fun to write. It was just a blast to write. So we're all set, and I'm looking at we're looking at the spring of 2018. That'll be out, and hopefully you and I can do another little thing about it.
Absolutely. I definitely want to read that one as soon as it's available, because that just sounds like an absolute hoot. And I live in Kansas, but I'm a Californian by birth. I went to school in Stockton at University of the Pacific, so I'm well familiar with everything that you're talking about. They used to, as a matter of fact, my college, UOP, it was often the site of both low-budget and very big-budget movies when they needed something that looked like an Ivy League school, but they didn't want to go back east. They came to UOP and filmed there. So it seemed like about once a semester at very least, it was like, well, there's going to be a movie crew at the Conservatory of Music, make sure you park someplace else type of thing. So I'm very, you can't come from California and not be interested in the industry. And this sounds just like that wonderful seamy underbelly portion of it. That is so.
Yeah, it's funny because the people we all kind of, it's funny, there's a bunch of Grips Electrics, camera people, sound people that I'm still very good friends with, and we all tell stories. We get together and we tell stories about the last one or this one. There's a strong narrative behind the creation of entertainment. There really is, and it's fun. I mean, it's like, it's always interesting, and not everything is, hellish. Sometimes they're wonderful experiences, they're incredibly, so it's not always a grind, but it's fun. It's, I don't know. It goes back to one of my, John Begg saying, John, you gotta write these stories down. I'm like, you're absolutely right. So here I am.
Well, now I'm gonna second that motion. You need to write those stories down. So now, since you're working on, you've got the new book, you're putting it in the can. What are you reading right now?
A friend of mine, the community of mystery writers, we were talking about, because Noah Hawley just won the Edgar and everything with his latest book, but my friend was saying, you know what, that's good, but the Good Father, which is a book he wrote years ago, for the listeners, Noah Hawley is the creative behind the new Fargo TV series, and he just won the Edgar for his most recent novel, but this The Good Father, I'm like, huh, okay. So I took his recommendation, and it's great. I mean, this guy's incredible. So, I mean, you can see why he's Noah Hawley. So anyways, yeah. So I'm reading that, and that's been great. The Ridge by John Rector I just finished recently, and he's another great talent. Talk about like short, tight, and to the point, thrilling. He's got that in spades. So that's what I'm reading.
Well, I'm glad to see, basically your publisher Down and Out. I'm glad to see them help being one of the the small presses that are reviving these novellas, these pulps, these very short, tight thrillers. And I want to wish you all the best at the Anthony Awards, along with your five other down and out alumni who are going to be squaring off on the Anthonys too. You guys are incredible. And I really want to thank you for coming in. Go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you, Terry. And I just have to say before we wrap up, I mean, if it wasn't for Eric Campbell, who is not afraid to embrace this novella format, who's like, yeah, why not? Let's do it. I mean, he understands. I think a lot of other publishers would shy away, but but he's not afraid. He's so ahead of the curve, and thank God. I mean, it's great that he has that as a publisher. He sees value there, and he says, yeah, let's do this and let's build something. I owe a massive gratitude to Eric and the team at Down and Out, because I love the fact that they're not afraid to publish a short form novella.
And it's obviously showing in their impressive showing this year at the Anthonys. And I think that it's only just the beginning of what we're going to be seeing out of Down and Out Press. And I wanted to say, my interview that I'm doing on Monday night, I think you might find interesting. His name is Gabino Iglesias, and he writes Barrio Noir.
Oh.
Very, very dark, very out there in a good way, and another look at a behind the scenes of something we normally don't see. He's doing the same thing. He's telling the stories that not everybody hears. He's also an extremely accomplished photographer, writer, blogger, etc. And that's going to be an extremely good interview. I'm just honored with the lineup I have for what I'm calling the Blitz Month, which is the introduction of the Blue Plate Special, which is multi-genre. You'll see everything from cozy romance through very, very hard-bitten crime through science fiction over this next month. And I've got a couple of housekeeping announcements here to make, and we'll wrap this up. But yes, I want you to contact me when the new book is ready, when the galleys are ready, and we'll get you scheduled in to talk about the new book when it comes out.
That's great, Karen. Thank you. I love the podcast, by the way. You guys are doing a great job. And man, just keep it up. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I wouldn't be here right now without the support from Down and Out Books and their 6 years of award-winning crime fiction. For listeners, you can check them out at www.downandoutbooks.com. And this podcast is fully owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. You can check us out on Facebook and the new website, authorsontheair.com. to not only find out what's scheduled on all the different shows that we have, I think there are 15 of them right now, you can also get links to the archives. So thanks for coming on, John, and you have a good evening, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Terry.
All righty, good night.